From the moment I was deposited back into civilian life after the Trump inauguration, I felt compelled to get away from what was happening in America. To emerge bleary-eyed from some international flight, change currency in the baggage claim, and walk into blinding sunlight and the cacophony of voices speaking another language along the curbside. Men, smoking in soccer jerseys, clustered around a metal pole. Was to be reminded that life went on, despite the sense of hostage-taking that afflicted my homeland. It was a form of self-imposed exile. And yet, in each locale, there was the discovery that the same thing was happening everywhere. In March 2017, I went to Myanmar to help the government there prepare for peace negotiations with a patchwork of provincial ethnic groups who had been waging civil war for decades. Diplomacy, it turned out, was privatized like everything else. I would be an independent contractor for a British-based non-governmental organization, NGO, led by Jonathan Powell, who had served as chief of staff for Tony Blair. Powell had led the negotiations to secure the Good Friday Accords that secured peace in Northern Ireland in the late 90s. Ever since, he'd become something of a globe-trotting private peacemaker from Africa to Latin America to Southeast Asia, a figure out of a Graham Greene novel, meeting rebels in jungles and deserts, seeking to recapture the accomplishment of his career's high watermark. Perhaps because I was newly admitted into the ranks of former officials, it seemed no surprise to Powell or his staff that I wanted to get to Burma a little early to unwind. We were trying to help end wars, but we were also dealing with our own private ones. For a couple of days, I walked aimlessly around the sprawling city of Yangon, a blanket of heavy heat over me, buying knockoff Nikes for a few bucks to make it easier on my feet. I went to a pagoda and sat staring at a Buddha, waiting to feel something. I walked into a U.S. government-funded library where I'd been a guest of honor a couple of years before. Now, anonymous to young Burmese buried in books and screens. Then I conducted workshops in the capital city of Naypyidaw to help the Myanmar negotiating team prepare, sharing lessons I'd learned while negotiating reconciliation between the United States and Cuba. The civilians took earnest, copious notes. The stern-faced military men in drab green uniforms wrote nothing down. Afterward, I joined a meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi, dissident turned state counselor, at her residence. For the first time in my several meetings with her, we were asked to take off our shoes inside the Buddhist home, a reminder of the Burmese Buddhist nationalism that had become more predominant in recent years. Within a matter of months, the Burmese military that had once imprisoned Suu Kyi would pursue a campaign of ethnic cleansing against a Muslim minority, the Rohingya. 1 million people were driven into neighboring Bangladesh. Through it all, Suu Kyi would remain silent. People wondered at her fall, from Nobel Peace Laureate of the early 90s to international pariah. But it made a certain kind of sad sense to me. A survivor from a country on the periphery of power in the world. She once surfed the wave of democracy that accompanied the end of the Cold War. She rocketed to international attention in 1989, the year that the Berlin Wall came down, by leading a democratic movement protesting the military government. By 2017, she was doing what she felt she needed to do to survive in a world where nationalism ran amok. Her own journey, from democracy icon to tacit collaborator in brutality fueled by Buddhist nationalism and rampant anti-Rohingya disinformation on Facebook, didn't cut against the currents of history. It drifted in the wake of events in the wider world. In April 2017, I went to Milan with Barack Obama. He was there to speak about climate change, a few weeks after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The rhythm of the trip felt familiar. A private plane, a block of hotel rooms, Secret Service agents. But the plane was a fraction the size of Air Force One. There were only a handful of hotel rooms and agents. And unlike the crush of responsibilities that used to follow me, I had very little to do. I accompanied Obama on a private tour of Leonardo da Vinci's drawings, peering down at bold lines, that improbably anticipated the machines of the future. Helicopters and missiles, the machinery of war that we'd presided over for 8 years. Dusty volumes, hundreds of years old, lined the walls of the library. From human creations like this, the Renaissance had emerged, paving the way for the pursuit of scientific inquiry and cultivation of a more enlightened Western civilization that now felt under assault. Back at the hotel, throngs of Italians waited outside Obama's hotel. I told him that he remained the most popular politician in the world. No, he corrected me. I'm one of the biggest celebrities in the world now. He didn't mean it as a good thing. Progressive change relegated to cultural celebrity.